Thank you, Shireen. I also want to thank Shireen for putting together this panel. She's done a tremendous amount of coordination. So my name is Chris Cable. I work at a small to mid-sized foundation in Portland, Oregon, called the Northwest Health Foundation. Our grant-making region includes the entire state of Oregon, five counties in southwest Washington. And since 2006, we've been investing in policy and environmental change strategies to improve opportunities for healthy eating and active living, particularly in communities where those opportunities are fairly scarce. Since 2008, we've also had a very intentional equity focus on what we did. But for whatever reason, the organizations that tended to apply for our healthy eating, active living grant opportunities did not adequately represent communities of color. And we felt this is a real shortcoming given the health equity implications. And so when the Innovation Fund RFP was released, we saw that as a real opportunity. Before I get into it, I do want to acknowledge I don't have any financial relationships to disclose. Who here has actually been to Portland or lived in Portland or currently lives in Portland? Oh, geez. Okay. So now I can't lie about what Portland really is. You've all been there. I would not do that. But, you know, oftentimes when I come to a conference like APHA or Smart Growth, I get this sort of, you guys in Portland, you've got it all figured out. This is an urban utopia. Everybody bikes to work. You've got great public transit. Everybody eats locally, sustainably grown food. And that is true in some communities, in some neighborhoods. But obviously those opportunities are not evenly distributed. And even a lot of people who live in Portland fall prey to that sort of smugness. But once you get east of 82nd Avenue, east of I-205 certainly, you get into neighborhoods that were only incorporated into the city of Portland in the 1980s and 90s. So they don't have the same sort of infrastructure, the same sort of historic networks that the rest of the city has. And increasingly, that's where low-income communities, immigrant and refugee communities, communities of color have been moving, because that's where the most affordable housing is. Because there's been a process of gentrification in a lot of the more historic neighborhoods. Those are the neighborhoods where we really have an interest in building community capacity to improve opportunities for healthy eating and active living. So just to illustrate, for those of you who are kind of in the back of the room, that the darkest green census tracts are those with the highest concentrations of communities of color. Historically, up until about 20 years ago, this map would have looked very different. The north and northeast Portland would have been very dark, and the rest of Multnomah County, which is where Portland is located, would have been exceedingly pale. But what we've seen in the last 20 years is certainly a shift out into East Portland, into Gresham, which is the city just to the east of Portland, and into these neighborhoods, again, that don't have the same park infrastructure, don't have the same sidewalk infrastructure, are not serviced by public transit to the same degree, where you can go a fairly long ways without running into a full-service grocery store. And this has a lot of equity considerations. So when the Innovation Fund RFP was released in 2009, this is some of the data we had access to. This is a map of obesity by census tract as is pulled from electronic health records in Kaiser Permanente. Now, these data have some limitations, which I acknowledge on the slide, so I'm not going to read them all, but KP does represent 19% of the covered lives in the county. So, you know, we're fairly confident this is a representative of a bigger phenomenon. And again, when you start to see the darkest red census tracts with the highest obesity prevalence, they correlate pretty strongly with where the communities of color are living. They also correlate pretty strongly with where the infrastructure is that provides opportunities for health. Just to give you a couple quick examples of how this plays out. So the Cully neighborhood in northeast Portland is now the most diverse census tract in the city. It's also the one of the poorest census tracts in the city. I'm going to talk a little bit more about Cully later in the presentation. David Douglas School District is in outer southeast Portland. About 10,000 students, 78% of whom are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. 67 different languages spoken in David Douglas School District. When a lot of people think of Portland, they don't necessarily think of 67 different languages being spoken in one school district. But that's the demographic reality that's happening. And so we felt a responsibility to address that. Oh, and I've lost control again of the mouse. The other factor that went into our pursuit of the Innovation Fund grant is that in addition to recognizing the equity considerations of these issues, we actually had an opportunity to do something meaningful about it. There are these major policy frameworks that were being developed at the time that could, if communities were properly resourced to influence them, could provide greater opportunities for health over decades. The big one is the Portland Plan. It's the first time since 1980 the city of Portland is revising its plan. It's going to guide the physical, social, and economic growth of the city for the next 30 years. The city started this process in 2006. I went to a few of those early planning meetings, and quite frankly, they were all folks who looked like me in this room. No communities of color represented in those policy discussions. There's the Portland Comprehensive Plan, which is more the sort of nuts and bolts policy document that implements the vision in the Portland Plan. Regional transportation plans being developed. Some pretty important food policy work going on. TriMet, which is our three-county regional transit agency, it's been going through a series of budget cuts over the last 3 years. They've cut 200,000 hours of bus service. A lot of that, those cuts have taken place out in East County. So there were no shortage of opportunities for community groups to be able to mobilize around. So after earning our grant, it was a $200,000 grant. We matched it with $200,000 of our own funds. We were able to convince six other funders to contribute the remaining $200,000 match. And we developed our proposal originally that we submitted with a group called the Coalition of Communities of Color, which is a coalition representing more than 40 culturally specific organizations in Multnomah County. And we felt it was really important that we develop our proposal as a team, that it wasn't just Northwest Health Foundation deciding how this should be, but designing that proposal collaboratively. After we earned the grant, we convened an 11-member advisory board that included the executive committee of that coalition, as well as representatives from contributing funders and public health. In particular, Multnomah County Health Department, the person who was running the Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant, we felt it was really important to have their collaboration. And what was really critical is when we released our RFP to the community, we required that the lead applicant on any incoming proposal be an organization that represented one or more communities of color. Now, this is something, it's probably not as novel in a lot of other parts of the country. In Portland, it was fairly novel. But we felt it was necessary because what had typically happened up to this point is Portland has a handful of really effective organizations that have been advocating on things like land use and transportation for a number of years. They're not terribly diverse, and we didn't want to just keep funneling more money into the same pockets. We wanted to diversify the field and make it inclusive and representative of the diversity of Multnomah County. So the lead applicant needed to be a culturally specific organization. They could choose whoever they wanted to be subgrantees. But we were very intentional about that choice. And then we allowed 3 months between the time we released the RFP and the time proposals were due because we realized we needed to do a lot of community outreach, engagement, education about what we were trying to achieve with this fund because this is a new topic area for a lot of organizations. We were awarded $600,000 in grants to seven organizations, three in the implementation track, four capacity building grants. They represent overall a really diverse mix of communities that were engaged, a diverse mix of policy targets, a diverse mix of strategies. They included some well-established groups like the Urban League and IRCO, but also a couple of environmental justice organizations. PCRI is an affordable housing provider. African Women's Coalition, Latino Network, were sort of like leadership development and advocacy organizations. So a real good mix of folks. We realized also we needed to be more than a grant maker if we really wanted to turn this into a movement. So we've been convening these organizations every 6 years so they could learn from each other, celebrate their successes, identify new opportunities for partnership. And we also developed a collaborative evaluation framework that allowed them to measure their progress because, as Shireen noted, these are only two-year grants. A lot of times the ultimate policy objective is not going to be achieved within that two-year time frame. But we felt it was necessary for organizations to have the tools to determine, what sort of interim benchmarks are we achieving that gets us towards where we want to go so that they can go back to their community, remain energized. And we've developed this framework within eight broad dimensions so that they could choose whatever sort of metrics were most appropriate for their scope of work. It's an online reporting system, and our grantees actually really appreciate it. In addition, I also want to thank PolicyLink. We were able to send 11 of our grantees to the PolicyLink Equity Summit, which is happening next week in Detroit. I wish I could go, but unfortunately I can't. But we're sending 11 of them to really deepen their expertise and learn from others in the field who are doing exciting work in other parts of the country. So I just want to do two quick case studies to kind of demonstrate what some of our grantees are doing. I mentioned earlier the Portland Plan. When this process started several years ago, quite frankly, the City of Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, equity was not really on the table. And that's not to disparage anyone who works in that bureau. They're all really professional, well-meaning people, but they just did not have that perspective. And more importantly, there wasn't really any sort of community groundswell to make equity part of the table or part of the conversation. And the reason this is important is that this is going to guide what every city bureau and every city office does for the next 30 years. So a number of our grantees have been advocating with the bureau, showing up at public hearings, drafting language to be included in the plan. And now, equity is the thing that holds the entire plan together. So there are three major strategies: thriving educated youth, healthy connected city, economic prosperity. And equity is the thing that the city now believes ties everything together. And it's reflected as you go step by step through this 90-page document, because it is a government agency and it's fairly extensive. So this is the final draft. City Council is slated to vote on the Portland Plan in December. But this is sort of one example of a policy victory with a capital P. More of a small sort of place-based strategy. One of our grantees is named Verde, which is really a multifaceted organization, but has a sort of a very strong environmental justice lens to what they do. And they've been advocating for a while for establishing Thomas Culley Park. I mentioned before, Culley, most diverse census tract now in the city of Portland, one of the lowest income. It's also most park deficient. And the city's owned this 25-acre plot of land for a number of years. It's just been sitting vacant. A few years ago, there was a very extensive community engagement process. The Latino community, which is is very large in Culley, was very involved in the master planning process. So there's a master plan that's been developed and is sitting on someone's desk in the city. And so Verde is using our grant to try to get this park actually implemented. Now, what's interesting about this project is, you know, originally, of course, you know, we kind of came to this project with a view towards, you know, does it improve opportunities for healthy eating and active living? For the residents who live in Culley, the major motivation is job creation, which is entirely natural. And from an equity standpoint, you know, if that's their primary motivation, that's terrific for me. I mean, either you can make a very strong case about economic development as connection to health. So the proposal from Verde to the city has very strong workforce and contracting stipulations in it to make sure that people who live in Culley actually get the jobs to create this park. Now, they've been getting a bit of the stiff arm from the city councilor who controls the Parks Bureau, so they've kind of changed their tactics. They're now approaching it more as a public-private partnership and trying to bite off little pieces of this 25-acre parcel to get them developed bit by bit and eventually demonstrate to the city that the momentum is inescapable and they better get on board this train. But it has a very strong sort of community self-determination angle to it, because this is, again, one of the more disadvantaged neighborhoods in Portland. This is a priority that the neighborhood has consistently said they want to see. And if they're able to achieve this victory, we're hoping that it demonstrates something about the leadership and the potential in this community, gives them a taste of their own powers so that they can go on and be successful in the next issue. They've also got some really strong partners. Hacienda is a community development corp that has a number of housing units in the area. A Native American Youth and Family Center, also a very strong partner. So, pardon me. In terms of lessons we've learned over the last 2 years, the first one's going to be a no-brainer for a lot of folks in this room. In terms of just, you know, community activism works. When funders support policy advocacy and community leadership development, it pays positive dividends. A lot of the partnerships we've been able to foster, especially across sectors, have really built the efficacy of the movement as well. And putting culturally specific organizations in the driver's seats for these sorts of policy endeavors has really changed the dynamic. Again, it's no longer just the usual suspects of four or five organizations who, again, not to disparage them, we fund all of them. They're really terrific organizations, but we needed a more inclusive movement if we're going to really shift the needle. And then finally, I just need to recognize that not every organization that has historically been seen their mission as providing direct services to their constituents can instantly and effectively jump on the policy and environmental change strategy. We've certainly seen that with a couple of our grantees. It's very difficult to change organizational DNA, and there's often sort of a tension internally between wanting to continue to provide that same level of direct service to their constituents, especially when those needs are increasing, while also being effective in that long-term sort of policy change arena. But we felt that's certainly a risk worth taking. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Lisa and be happy to take your questions at the end of the session. Thank you.